This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Alex Steffen, co-founder and executive editor of worldchanging.com, a nonprofit media organization headquartered in Seattle, Washington, that comprises a global network of independent journalists, designers, and thinkers, and is one of the world's leading sustainability-related publications. Alex is also editor of World Changing, a User's Guide to the 21st Century, which won the Green Prize for Sustainable Literature. Alex Steffen is here today to tell us about the key role of cities in moving towards sustainability and how the city of Seattle can help create a more sustainable future. Welcome, Alex.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Would you like to begin by saying a few words about worldchanging.com?
Sure. World Changing is a nonprofit. We focus on solutions-based journalism. So basically what we're interested in is not so much defining the problem and certainly not so much laying blame for the problem, but rather trying to look at a set of interconnected solutions to sustainability and social issues and trying to figure out if there aren't better ways of approaching those solutions, what the pros and cons of various solutions might be, and how we might in general sort of move a holistic set of better answers forward.
What do you see as the role of cities in moving toward global sustainability?
Well, cities are pretty much the defining leverage point for creating global sustainability. We live already on a planet where most people are urban. That is going to increase dramatically over the next 20 years until by about 2050, the vast majority of people will be living in cities. And when you count sort of the hinterlands around cities, the suburbs and rural areas that are deeply tied to those cities, basically, effectively, everybody will be living in cities, outside of a handful of people living in traditional lifestyles in the Arctic and such. And so fundamentally, if you can't get those cities right, you can't get anything else about sustainability right. On the other hand, if you do get those cities right, we are finding that you actually have all sorts of capacities to leverage sustainable prosperity in a way that we really didn't understand that we could before. Cities offer us the opportunity to have lifestyles that are much more prosperous and lives that are of a much higher quality while greatly reducing the impact of those things. And since we're headed towards 9 billion people on the planet, most of whom want to live a lifestyle closer to the North American lifestyle than the lifestyle they have currently, that means that we need to create a system of prosperity that can, in fact, be adopted by billions more people. And the only way that we're going to do that is by creating a prosperity that is very low impact. And in turn, the only way we can do that is by creating really, you know, an urban, bright green prosperity.
In what ways are unsustainable behaviors encouraged by our cities as they currently exist?
Well, I think we need to talk about each city in a different light because cities themselves are very different and they're very different across regions. Here in Seattle, our biggest problem in terms of sustainability is really auto dependence. We have a lot of benefits here in Seattle. We have a terrific mild climate, which means that we don't spend a lot of energy on heating buildings. We have hydropower and other clean energy sources, which means that we are increasingly moving to, you know, a carbon neutral electrical grid, and that's really terrific. We have a lot of local food and a lot of sort of sustainable consumption kinds of ideas here. So in many ways, we're already doing some really great stuff, but where it all kind of comes apart is around the car. Cars are the biggest single source of climate emissions here. They're the biggest source of pollution in Puget Sound. But even more importantly, the effect that cars have on the built landscape is really corrosive in terms of sustainability and social justice and good urban planning. When you have excessive auto dependence, what you end up having is lots of low-density sprawl, lots of homes and workplaces and shops flung far away from each other, meaning people have to drive farther and farther distances. You have a lot of people spending a lot of time in cars, which is correlated to obesity and early death. We have a very high rate compared to, say, Europe, of people dying in car accidents. And we have a very, very high rate of pedestrians and bicyclists being killed by car drivers. And, you know, in general, we end up finding that cars really undermine a lot of the things that we'd like to do. But we don't tend to take on the problem of cars as directly as we ought to here.
What do you see as the most important elements of a more sustainable city? And perhaps you could speak in general, and then later we could come back and talk in more detail about Seattle.
Well, the prime elements of a sustainable city are, first of all, density. It is in bringing people nearer to one another and to the things and services that they want that cities offer their real potential. Not only do people who live in smaller spaces that are better designed and closer together end up using a lot less energy and materials directly in their lives, right? Smaller units tend to be more energy efficient. They take less energy and materials to build. People who live in close proximity are less likely to drive a lot and more likely to be able to take transit where they want to go. But also that mere element of proximity itself, of having lots of things close by, lets people live in a different way. First of all, it eliminates a lot of trips because the most sustainable trip is the one you never took because what you want is just down the street, right? But also, it helps people have a different relationship to the stuff in their lives. When everybody lives in sort of McMansions on five-acre lots, there's a certain momentum there that tends to help people want to have lots of stuff because it's just darn inconvenient to not have it in your home, right? A classic example being a home gym. If you live a 15-minute drive from the nearest gym, you're much less likely to go there, so you're much more likely to think that a home gym is a good investment. If you live in an urban neighborhood, you're much more likely to have a gym right down the block. And by having a gym close by, you don't need to have one in your home. And what's true for gyms turns out to be true for an awful lot of products and services. You know, if you live in an urban neighborhood, you are far more likely to have access to, for instance, a public library, perhaps a tool sharing service or co-op or rental place. So you don't necessarily need a home workshop to get stuff done. You are much more likely to be involved in product service systems, right? So you might be able to get rid of one of your cars because you know that it's easy to get a car share car at short notice. And that is an increasingly strong trend, is things like car sharing and bike sharing, shared kitchen services, rentals instead of ownership, so on and so forth. So when you combine the inherent advantages of compact development, right, which uses less energy and helps people take fewer trips to get the same amount of stuff done, with the benefits towards redefining the way that people engage in consumption, what you end up finding is that cities can, in fact, offer a comparable quality of life to our conventional sort of sense of prosperity, which is largely suburban, while in fact slashing the energy and materials use of that life by 60-70%. And when you add the kind of technological breakthroughs we're beginning to see in terms of things like green buildings, in terms of things like green infrastructure, right, cities that operate a little more like nature and are a little more effective at dealing with things like stormwater and so forth, then you actually start finding that it's possible to imagine urban lifestyles that use 90-95% less energy and materials. And at that point, you start to get to a vision of urban sustainability that could actually be shared by billions of people around the planet.
You are listening to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Alex Steffen, executive editor of worldchanging.com. Our topic is sustainable cities and steps the city of Seattle can take to move towards a more sustainable future. In one of the postings on your worldchanging.com website, you speak about the need to replace machines in the city of the future. Would you explain?
Sure. Many of the systems that we still use in our cities are systems that were developed in the industrial era as answers to problems that they had then, right? An absolutely classic one is the car. If you are trying to figure out how to deal with the problem of not knowing where things are and not knowing where you need to be, then the ability to drive around rapidly to find things is very helpful. But in a society that has a better grasp of its information resources, where you can actually find the object you want to go looking for very quickly and easily, having to get there in 2 tons of metal driven by an internal combustion engine is a really sloppy, inefficient, and unethical way of doing things. And that kind of principle applies to a lot of things. We know, for instance, that right now we spend an enormous amount of energy and material and money getting water from distant places, in the case of Seattle, from the Cedar River watershed, piping it through huge pipes to Seattle, then, you know, largely wasting huge volumes of it before flushing it out through sewage treatment plant into the sea. And we know that there are much more effective ways of dealing with local water, of dealing with runoff, of harvesting rainwater and using that in gardens, of even, you know, moving towards harvesting gray water, the water that's a little bit dirty that we use, things like the dishwater that we have or shower water. There are ways of using these things that actually mean that we don't have to have a city that is completely serviced by massive machinery pumping water from distant places. And more we're realizing that if we design cities the right way, we don't work against the natural flows of sunlight and wind and rain, but we use those things, right? We use those things to heat our homes, to cool our homes, to provide the water we need for our homes and for our gardens, and to make sure that what's around us is not, you know, slabs of asphalt and the pollution of industrial machinery, but rather really well-designed systems that look more like nature. And so we end up having a city that is much denser, but it's also a lot greener and more pleasant, which is, I think, sort of the paradox of bright green cities, is that if you do them right, you end up having a lot more people living in a smaller space, and yet it feels less crowded and more green than the kind of environments that we live in today.
Would you comment on the role of community and of meeting places in the sustainable cities of the future?
Well, I think that community is absolutely critical. I think that we sometimes mistake what community is good for. Community is vital when part of what you're trying to do is to live a life where you only own what you need to own or what you want to own, and you share or rent or have community access to, you know, the other goods and services that you might want in the course of a day. A classic example of this is tool co-ops, which are a really big burgeoning trend around the world and actually quite widely adopted now down in Portland, our neighbor to the south here, where people in a community get together and in various different ways they basically create a tool library. And so if you end up finding yourself needing a power drill, you can go borrow one instead of buy it, which actually ends up being a pretty great thing in a couple different ways. First of all, it saves you money, a lot of money. Second of all, it actually has a lot lower ecological impact because the average home drill actually gets only used somewhere between 6 and 20 minutes in its entire lifetime, depending on whose numbers you believe. So you have this piece of metal and plastic and machinery that took a lot of energy to create that sits doing nothing on a shelf for most of its life. There's absolutely no reason why a well-designed community system shouldn't make it easy for people to share access to a couple drills and save a lot of money and ecological damage in the process. So having a strong sense of community like that, that allows people to trust each other in that kind of a process, is pretty critical. In addition, I think that we are going into a time where we're going to see a really dramatic amount of change. I would say it's a pretty safe bet that we're going to see as much change in the next 20 years as we saw in, say, the last 60 or 70 years. Really just remarkable amounts of change. And I think that in order for us to really take care of each other and take care of people, we have to have strong communities that will help people who perhaps don't make the transition as easily and that can make sure that that change is buffered a bit on people who are having a hard time adjusting. Now, all that said, I think that there's often a mistake made in some sustainability circles in sort of understanding what community is good at and not good at. Some of the things that community is not good at is replacing essential pieces of infrastructure. We really need effective urban and regional and state and federal governance in order to deal with the big problems we have in terms of transportation, energy, water, et cetera. These are things that really effectively can't be done at a local level. There are people who are trying and some people who even have done a good job, but they're aberrations fundamentally. Most people don't want to even tackle those things at a local level. So I think that we need to separate out the things that we need to be active as citizens in trying to create, which are these big pieces of infrastructure, and things that we need to be active as community members which I think are really about human interconnection and the ability to have strong ties between people. In an ideal city, I think we would see both of those things functioning really well. Citizenship and community membership would be really strong.
Would you comment on what you see as the drawbacks of taking small steps in green living as a way of moving towards sustainability?
Sure. Well, I mean, the most fundamental drawback is that they don't make much of a difference. Most of the things that we have been taught to do in terms of living sustainably, in quotes, don't actually change our overall footprint very much at all. Most of our footprint comes from the big things that we do, right? It comes from the kind of home we live in, the location of our home relative to our work and other places we visit a lot, how we get around, and the infrastructural systems that exist to support that life, like energy and water, and then also the things that big institutions are doing in our name and with our tax money, right? The federal government, the state government, local government. Those things are pretty much definitive of our impact. In addition, there are large kinds of impacts that we can't directly see in our day-to-day lives that are also pretty huge, right? We don't necessarily see the impact of manufacturing a piece of cheap electrical equipment in China, right? So we don't tend to think of that impact as part of our own. But in fact, that backstory to our lives, the hidden costs of the prosperity that we have, is pretty vital. Because of those things, we tend to focus on the things that we can see most easily, which is like, what are we throwing in the trash? What are we buying at the store? And that tends to involve a process of self-deception, where we don't do the things that are really important, but we get a little freaked out about the things that aren't so important. I describe that process as the privatization of responsibility, and I think it's a bad thing. I think that we need to look at the responsibility for changing towards sustainability as a public, communal one, something we all need to do together, and only very incidentally a private one. And I really believe that to the extent that we make sustainability a private virtue is pretty much the extent that we are guaranteed to destroy the planet.
You are listening to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Alex Steffen, executive editor of worldchanging.com. Our topic is sustainable cities and steps the city of Seattle can take to move towards a more sustainable future. Let's focus in now specifically on Seattle. You've alluded to it earlier, but in your view, where do we currently stand in our efforts to move towards sustainability?
Well, I think we have to grade on a curve here. There are some things that Seattle is excellent at that we have done a really great job of, but they tend to be things that are kind of gimmies given where we're located and the kind of city we are. We have a really excellent set of public utilities. Seattle City Light, Seattle Public Utilities are really phenomenally good, actually. They're national, if not international, leaders, and we have clean energy readily available to us. We have a more and more thoughtful system of water infrastructure. That stuff's going really well, but it's largely a result of the fact that we live in a place that has a moderate climate, lots of rainfall, and cheap hydropower. When we start to get to the stuff that's a little tougher and a little more directly our choice, that's where we start to see more failing grades. We have fallen far behind many other cities in terms of implementing sustainability policies. And the biggest place we've failed is around land use. Because of sort of neighborhood NIMBY opposition to some earlier plans, like the comprehensive plan, which would have led to urban villages, we are now far behind some of our neighbors like Vancouver and Portland, much less internationally leading cities like Melbourne and Copenhagen. Those places have figured out how to make compact communities that are walkable, that are transit supportive, and that use far less energy to deliver even more economic value. And we haven't done that. We have really failed to make our neighborhoods within Seattle as compact as they need to be, and we've completely failed to check sprawl and to make sure that the suburbs that we have are actually developing as communities rather than as just subdivisions. There are a couple exceptions to that rule, right? There are a couple neighborhoods that have done a great job, such as Ballard, and there are a couple suburban cities that have done a great job, like Kirkland. But overall, there are exceptions that prove the rule. Seattle, the metropolitan area, is still incredibly auto-dependent. We drive a very large amount. Those autos are the leading cause of our greenhouse emissions. They're also the leading cause of pollution in Puget Sound, and they have enormous health costs and enormous economic costs. And until we're really ready to tackle that fundamental challenge, we're going to fail at being a sustainable city because there's just no way to make car dependence sustainable. We can make slightly better cars. We can make plug-in electric cars. They are better at their actual operations. But that doesn't change anything about the larger system in which cars are embedded, right? It doesn't change the costs of manufacturing a car, of maintaining a car, of disposing of a car at the end of its life cycle. It doesn't make roads any less ecologically impactful. It doesn't cut down on the number of parking spaces we're building. It doesn't bring people closer together in more walkable communities. It doesn't reduce the rate of obesity. It doesn't reduce the number of people getting killed in car accidents or being hit by cars. All of those things can only be changed by changing the way that you have land use and the way that that affects transportation. And I think that's going to be the next giant fight in the Seattle area.
So focusing more on the steps that we need to take to really make a difference in Seattle in moving towards sustainability, what do we need to foster that we are already doing?
As I mentioned before, we have excellent public utilities, and we really ought to be supporting their work and, if anything, even urging them on even more. They operate very well, very sustainably in comparison to most places, but they're also encouraging us to do better, and we should encourage them in return, right? We should focus on things like energy efficiency, water efficiency, and really pushing conservation on those things forward. That's an easy, quick win that we should and could be doing. We also should and could be raising our green building standards. Right now, we encourage green buildings, but our overall building codes are still pretty out of date. It's quite possible to build within the city of Seattle an energy and water hog house that takes tons of materials and is guaranteeing a pretty inefficient lifestyle for its residents for decades to come. That's not the way you do it. Places that are really charging forward on green building are raising their building standards themselves rapidly so that the worst house that is built new is better than maybe the best house that was built a few years ago. And I think that we need that level of innovation. I think we also need to really be focused on building better neighborhoods. We have phenomenal opportunities here in terms of light rail and the possibility of new light rail lines. We have terrific neighborhood cores that can really be an anchor and support more housing and more shops and really become places that people can center their lives around. I live in Columbia City, and Columbia City is just getting better and better, and I think that with the density that's coming in now, it's going to actually be a phenomenally great neighborhood and served by a light rail line to downtown, and that's more of what we need. We need more of that and less of sort of the auto-dependent edges of the city. I think we also really need to focus on the connections between neighborhoods. There's a concept that I call deep walkability, which has to do with not only how walkable is your immediate neighborhood. Can you step out your front door with your kid and walk in safety to the store down the street? But also how walkable is the area between your neighborhood and other neighborhoods, right? Can you start walking from your house and walk to the next neighborhood over in a safe and comfortable way? And that's something that Seattle has not done as good a job on as it could. There are still many places, frankly, my neighborhood, Columbia City, where though the neighborhood itself may be walkable, getting anywhere else is pretty difficult. In order for me to walk downtown, I have to walk down Rainier, which is probably the least pedestrian-friendly street in Seattle. And we need to do better. In order to do better on that, I think we're going to need to really de-emphasize the car. There has been this idea in policy and planning circles in Seattle that we can have it both ways, that we can be auto-dependent and have a great quality of life. But the reality is that's not true. We need to choose auto-dependence, which I think is a terrible choice, or really building more sustainable communities. And that means that we need to, frankly, privilege other options ahead of cars. Right now, we kind of go out of our way to make it easy to drive around. We don't kind of. We very much go out of our way to make it easy to drive around. And the argument that something might slow traffic or might eliminate parking spaces is seen as a fatal flaw. I think that if we look at other cities that are doing well, that are really prospering and that are really moving forward, what we find is they all have strong commitments to, in fact, reversing the trend of auto dependence. So they emphasize the ownership of pedestrians and bicyclists in urban spaces. That might mean more bike lanes, wider sidewalks, but it also means like speed limits and more stoplights and signals that tell drivers, you need to slow down here. And those signals are often built into the roads themselves, right? So narrower roads, speed bumps, different kinds of pavements, etc. There are lots of ways to tell drivers, hey, this isn't a freeway. You need to be careful here. But even beyond that, there are some structural things we can do in terms of not only supporting transit, but also supporting policies that really move people out of their cars. So putting a pretty stiff tax on parking, really encouraging new development to not include parking spaces. That makes the new development much cheaper for the people who live there. But it also means that the portion of people who want to live without a car, which is a rising number of people, I believe it's something like 15 or 16% of households in Seattle already don't own a car. Those people have affordable homes that they can live in. and that are close to the things that they want. And we need to be taking those kinds of steps and really moving Seattle away from auto dependence. I think we need to be doing that for a reason that has also very little to do with environmental sustainability, which is economic sustainability. We know that we're headed into a time where oil prices are going to start rising dramatically. That's not an eco-thinker idea. That's a very mainstream economics idea. And yet we're doing almost nothing to protect our regional economy from the effects of rising prices of oil and other materials. And if we want to be competitive in the future, if we don't want to suffer a prolonged recession as fuel prices rise, we need to start banking heavily on options that aren't dependent on large amounts of oil. And that really means, again, emphasizing pretty much everything else over cars. And that's not a popular thing to say in Seattle, certainly not in the Seattle suburbs, but I think that it's an absolutely vital way to move forward.
What do you think is most standing in the way of Seattle's progress towards sustainability?
Well, I think a couple things. I mean, I think that the biggest thing that we face is just this problem with cars, that we like to sort of dodge that. Even a lot of us who are sustainability advocates get a little quiet when that question comes up in Seattle. But fundamentally, I think that we can't have a sustainable city unless we drive an awful lot less and unless many fewer people have cars and those who have cars drive them much more infrequently and the roads are really used for pedestrians and bicyclists and freight. That's, I think, one of the biggest ones, is that we have this unwillingness, for whatever reason, to confront that essential challenge. I think another problem we have is that we have a poor sense of what urban politics needs to be about here. When I compare Seattle to other metropolitan regions, I think we do a really poor job of having elected officials at the local level, at the state level, even to some degree at the federal level, who really understand the kinds of investments that make cities work and understand the need to move towards smart growth and livable communities to really dramatically shift money away from auto transportation to other modes of transportation. I read the other day that it's still something like 98% of state transportation money is spent on cars. That's an absurd figure. We have had repeated problems where the state legislature has decided that in its wisdom that there are auto-focused solutions that we ought to be taking, even when we know there's a better option, such as the downtown tunnel, even when we know that a streets and transit option would work even better and cost a lot less money. We really need to, I think, have a higher level of expectation on our elected officials and on our community leaders about understanding what urbanism is, and that urbanism is not only the key to our quality of life, it's the key to our environmental sustainability and our economic competitiveness. And I think that we need to raise the bar of expectations on people and start expecting them to do dramatically better, not just marginally better.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Well, I think if there's anything at all that I'd like people to come away with, it's that we need to make big changes here in Seattle, and that this is the year we're going to make them or not make them. We have a new mayor who, whatever his flaws, does really believe in making this a more urban, sustainable city. We have a council which has already made some bold moves, including declaring just the other day that Seattle's going to aim to become a carbon-neutral city, but also that has declared its willingness to engage in processes of compact development and of better transportation planning and so forth. We even have some state legislators who are pretty good and get what ought to be happening. But overall, we have this moment where questions are coming up about what we ought to do. And because of the recession, we really have some time to make some good plans before the next boom hits. So I would just encourage people to really get involved, and to get involved at a neighborhood level, at a city level, to find out who their state representatives and senators are, and to really encourage those people to invest serious amounts of money in public transportation, in walkability, in bikeability, in improving green building standards, and really welcoming into our communities a much larger degree of density and compact development. I don't think you can be against density and call yourself an environmentalist anymore. And I think that if we really want to be seeing a change, we need to get our heads around that, and we need to start speaking out and helping other people understand it as well.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Alex.
Absolutely. It's my pleasure.
You have just been listening to Alex Steffen, Executive Editor of WorldChanging.com. For more information, check on the web at www.worldchanging.com. Again, that's worldchanging.com. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the Sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM and KEXP.org.